Now, I have a few minutes, only five, so if you'll allow me, maybe I can say a number of things that need to be said in this country. That needs to be said in this country. And that's what I want to talk about. Now, I want to talk to black people across this country. I want to talk to black people across this country. There are four things we have to do. Number one, we have to stop being ashamed of being black.
Born in 88, spent my whole life stressing. Young adolescent, raised in aggression. You ain't on the same page, ain't a thing you can tell us. Overly rebellious, running with the fellas. Sitting in class, about half of us felons. It's a cold world, motherfucker, who you telling? Shit, today I got hit with a repossession. Now my eyes bloodshot, looking like a possession. Gotta make ends meet, man, how we gon' eat? But those kind of questions, tell me how I'm gon' sleep. Tell me how I'm gon' sleep.
Because this country is built on lies. They told you and me that if we worked hard and if we sweated, that we would succeed and become rich. And if that were true, I tell you, we would own this country. You went to Africa with the Bible. We had the land. When you left Africa, you had the land, we had the Bible.
Come on. If I only myself, what good is this protection? Man, I could have died, collide in the sections. I know this could all be gone in a second, so I give a good deep, like an interception. Oh, I flow and let it go every session. Microphone hanger, M16s, sleeping on me, motherfucker, sweet dreams. I've been doing me since I was 16. Comrade music, boldly addressing. 5-0 quota, killing the rest of them. We won't have closure till we take over. We won't have closure till we take over.
All right. Thank you for tuning in once again. This is the It's Going Down podcast. This is the first podcast we've released since the Orange Cheeto has entered the building on January 20th. We know people are dealing with a lot of repression, a lot of arrests, a lot of trumped up charges, if we can say that with a straight face. So our hearts go out to everybody that's dealing with that. We really hope that you all get through it, that we all make it through this, that we all support each other. Again, It's Going Down is a platform that we can share news, analysis, and also if you need help raising some cash, get at us. Today we have a really important interview with Bobbi London. She is an anti-authoritarian, horizontalist, anti-capitalist writer and thinker. We're going to be talking about anti-blackness, liberalism, and the possibilities and realities of black insurgency in the current period. This is a great interview. We really enjoyed it. Bobbi London, you rock. Thanks for coming on. Without further ado, here's Bobbi London. Thanks a lot. This is It's Going Down, itsgoingdown.org. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, become a sustainer. Help us continue this work. We're getting more listeners, more people cluing into what we're doing than ever before. So let's continue this. This is about building community power, autonomy, self-defense, and resiliency against a system that forces us to be poor, to be precarious, and to live lives that are unfulfilled and unforgiving. Okay, we're joined here today with Bobbi London. We're going to be talking about a lot of different stuff. This is the first recording we've done since Trump has been inaugurated. And Bobbi, let's just get right into it. What led to you getting radicalized and how did you start writing? You have a website, thisisbobbilondon.com. How did that all come about?
That's kind of a long answer. I'll try to answer it shortly. I recently posted something called Lemon Grenades, and that kind of explains how Bobbi London kind of came to be. I would say on one layer, a large part of my radicalization came through Occupy. But, like, it's weird saying that because when people hear Occupy, they kind of get a certain, like, idea of you, an idea of what it was. And so, and I was a part of Occupy LA or participated in Occupy LA. So, you know, like, yes. And like the outer element of it, it was a very white, liberal, controlled movement. But to me, like, what really was great about it was the whole movement underneath that that was trying to rebel against that. And that was consistently trying to fight against the co-optation, like daily. and sort of through that, you know, like my day one of being there and someone saying like, you can't take the streets or you need to put your tent here or you can't do this. And just noticing that there was an official hierarchy, even though it was supposed to be horizontal. And I didn't even know what horizontal meant back then, you know. But like, I mean, in a sort of political way. And so it was through the experience of consistently having to like confront these really aggressive orgs and liberals that I found myself constantly pushing back and speaking out. And then there was like this one summer, 2012, which was like, you know, the camp had already been done, but like it was still kind of happening. And I found myself in like, of just like the summer of just like constant conflict and like uprisings. And I know people kind of have a certain idea of like when people use uprisings and it's not like, you know, guns blazing or anything like that. But when I use it, I mean, in a sense of like there was police violence and people responded back. And it wasn't intentional. And so I found myself just constantly in these uprisings and it just kind of changed the way I saw things. And it was just interesting because I remember I participated in this one, you know, it was a community. They were going to the city council meeting to speak out against someone who had been shot. And, you know, I thought it was just going to be like, you go to the meeting, whatever, some people speak out. So I'm wearing like a dress and platform, a dress and ballerina slippers, and it ends up turning into a march. We end up marching all day, then people start, you know, doing other things, and then we start end up getting shot with rubber bullets and tear gas, and then it turns into a riot. And the next week, there was like an organizer, like activist planned event to kind of like follow that up. And just the feeling of being in like the one that was organic versus the one that was, you know, created by this sort of activist culture, it just felt so fake and not real. And so I feel like all of that kind of really shaped my politics. And then I started writing, just as a way of kind of doing counter media. Because there was so much, there would be so many times I would go somewhere and, you know, the local news, like NBC, would say, oh, protesters did this or did that, and that's not what happened. And so I started kind of becoming my own, you know, reporter of what was happening and through there. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the best introduction we've had on the show so far. Well, yeah, that's really fascinating about your Occupy experience. Maybe when we get into some other stuff, we can revisit that because I think that's really interesting and it's awesome that you had that kind of reaction to that bullshit when you're out there. And also, it sucks that was your kind of like coming into the fold of things. But real quick, just before we get into some of the other things, can you talk about some of your media projects, like your website? And just some of the other stuff that you're working on right now, just so people are aware of it going into this interview.
Sure. So I have my website. This is Bobby London. I never really intended for it to be the name and stick. I wrote something and I just wanted to hurry up and publish it and I didn't know what to do. And so I was like, I'm just going to do it this. And my friends were like, yeah. And I was like, eventually I'll change it. And I never changed it. So yeah, I have that, and then I'm a part of On Resistance, which it started off as a larger collective, but now it's just me and Jay, and we have a radio show on KPFK in LA, but we also repost it on our SoundCloud, and we've been doing it for 5 years, which is crazy, because it's cool. I mean, like, KPFK isn't necessarily, like, the most like welcoming place for people with politics like ours. And like specifically being young, there's a lot of like ageism there. Yeah. So we're constantly like, oh, they're gonna cancel us yet? Like But we have, our program director has been really supportive, so that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, that's interesting you brought that up. I've heard that in similar instances, like people that are involved in, I'm assuming this is kind of like other Pacifica. It's like a Pacifica station.
Yeah,
and I've heard from other people that like at similar studios, it's almost like this. It's not even necessarily like, I mean, obviously there's like political differences, but it's more of like a generational thing or people not wanting younger people to come in and infringe on their territory or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, it sucks too, because I mean, like, that's how you keep it going, right? Like,
yeah.
I think there's a lot we can mutually learn from each other. And like, I'm getting older. I don't want to be excluded either. I can understand that. I just think with resources, when it's limited, people get really like, you know, wanting to keep it for themselves. And yeah, we can have a whole conversation on sort of Pacifica and the idea of that sort of type of media. But yeah.
Right. Okay, great. So Trump is now in office on January 20th. We saw massive mobilizations across the U.S. and the world. And then we saw on January 21st the even larger women's marches. What are your initial thoughts on both of these events? There's been a lot written so far. You know, a lot of critical stuff about the women's march has been put out. A lot of report backs on J20th. Any initial thoughts on both of these days?
So first on J20, I was really happy to see that there was a Black bloc and that they did stuff. I wasn't expecting much, so I was happy. It was inspiring, especially because in LA, even if it didn't, LA was raining like really, really intense. But even if it wasn't, it wouldn't have been that. And so I was happy to see that like people around the country were, you know, we're doing more than just like the kind of parade stuff. Mm-hmm. But then like there's still that element of spectacle, which I've seen like some of my friends talk about. But overall, I'm just happy to see that it wasn't just like, you know, this answer and BLM and these like orgs doing things. And then on the White Cis Women March, I think, you know, there's this thing now where people love to go to protests and it's all about the sign, right? And so you try to think of some witty sign so you can take a picture and then it goes viral. And like, that's all it's about. You know, and you had all these celebrities there and it's just a show and the politics of it, of course, you know, many people have been saying it. It's just it's white feminism. It's very exclusionary. And even if you have, you know, different faces and, you know, different identities on the stage speaking, like the actual real movement of it is for, you know, white cis women. And it also, to me, it's very like, it hurts because you see that people have showed out and like come in record numbers to protest, but it's like, where have you been in all these years when people have been, you know, in the streets for police brutality or for, you know, ICE raids or for, you know, like anything else, you know, or when trans women have been getting murdered, like, where have all these people felt such a strong urge to need to get in the streets and do something, and they didn't. And it just shows the lack of intersectionality, because if there really was intersectional, then those people would have already been in the streets. And so I feel like, yeah, it's just, that's going to be another obstacle that people whose politics are like mine are going to have to like deal with, because liberals aren't safe to be around in protests. And also just like the whole idea of getting permits, and when an org makes a call out, it's very, it establishes territory over an event. So it's like when Trump won, it's like, boom, first thing you hear is like Women's March. And so it's like, that's established. That's the main show, right? Like, cause everything's a spectacle. So that's like the main stage. And then everything else is just kind of like sideshows. And in LA, you had March and Rally LA, and then you had the Women's March LA. And they had worked with the police. They had talked to the cops on how they're going to make it the most convenient for the cops to control. And, you know, and they had gotten permits, even though people before had talked to them about why it's important not to get permits. And so they just didn't care, right? And so it's frustrating.
Yeah, it almost feels in some of those situations like it's like the day after like big riots take place, or at least like large scale disruptions in a lot of cities, that it's like, well, this is how you really do it.
Yeah, definitely. And then people were saying that, right? Like there were people who were hugging cops, which the same thing happened during November when everyone was doing the anti-Trump protests. Like there was a liberal march and they were like, there's like a GIF that you can see, and actually in my Fuck Trump but Fuck You Too article, of them like standing like in line shaking hands with cops, like with the right line, or like the, and you're just like, what are you doing? Like, they don't.
What do you, because this is something some friends of mine brought up recently, but I mean, do you think it even makes sense to like engage with that? Like, should people be like handing out flyers, like, you know, here's another perspective, or trying to like intervene in those demonstrations at all and like try to do breakaway marches or something? Or do you think it's just like, it's pointless to even engage at that level?
It's hard to say, because I went to one of the, like, the one I was mentioning before, like in November when it was the anti-Trump march, and it was very liberal. And I went with a friend, and we were in like all black, and we had like black flags, and just that, like just our presence made so many people uncomfortable. And they didn't, like, they were just like, so, you know, we weren't doing anything, but just like it disrupted what was, you know, that kind of happy, this is like Trump love, you know, love not hate kind of BS. And so there's like a part of it where I feel like if you have enough people, like you could use these like liberal marches as a way to do other things, which people have done. But then also it's very not safe, because they'll snitch on you if they see something. They'll try to intervene if they see something. Like the person did Adventurous, did you see the video with the liberal taking a video of like chasing after the person that punched Richard Spencer?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I don't know if I've seen it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and so this person like chased this person and was like, what are you doing? You know, and it's like, and that's what liberals do. Like that's exactly what would happen. And so it's just not, it's also not safe, you know?
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like another part of the state all around you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you brought it up, but the next question is your essay. I love the title, Fuck Trump, But Fuck You Too, No Unity with Liberals. Excuse me. was critical of what you call the safety pin allies. Can you talk more about this? Many people have been calling for more unity with liberals and leftists of all stripes since Trump has been inaugurated, or, you know, selected by the Electoral College. Why do you think it's important on your side to draw these hard lines at a time when people are calling for, you know, quote unquote left unity?
So in that piece, just give background, I talk about when I went out, and I went by myself, which, you know, isn't a good idea, but I went like as with my press pass. I was like, I'm just gonna go as press, you know. And I ended up, you know, seeing some cop be aggro and start to push people. And, you know, said, fuck the police. And, like, all the attention, not from the cops, but from the people around me, I got all of the attention. And they started, like, pushing at me. And this one woman hit my head.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And it was, like, it was really, it was, like, a out-of-body experience. Because you're just, like, it was, like, everything was going so slow. And I remember making eye contact with the cop. And he's, like, looking, smiling. Because, like, here he was pushing them, you know what I mean? And they're all being like, and they're like pushing me, telling me to be peaceful. And so it was at that moment where I was just like, you can't, I can't be here with you, you know, like there's no,
oh my God.
And I had other friends who were talking to me who were in different places at that time, and, you know, the same thing. And so so I understand why people want unity, like, because it's easier, right? Like, the masses, the people, if we all come together, we can win. Yes, And like, but the reality is like what we want is very different. And so, there's a lot of energy to have to constantly have to explain yourself or defend yourself. You know, when you're out of action and you want to take the streets and they're like, no, don't do that. Or if you want to chant something, or if you want to break something, if you want, anytime you want to do something, if you're constantly having to like defend yourself or like how, you know, or have to protect yourself from people who are supposed to be on the same side of you, like the question is then like, what side are you really on? And so, I think that it's not possible. Like, I don't really think there is unity. I think what unity would mean would be for me to have to compromise what I want, would be for me as someone who wants autonomy to have to basically give up that autonomy because, like, I'm working with hierarchical people or I'm working with people who are authoritarian or who are pro-state. And so it's like, I just don't think the unity can exist. And yeah, that's just a lot of energy. And so I think that like what really needs to happen is people who are anti-statist, anti-authoritarian, horizontal, who want to fight for their own autonomy, like we need to organize with each other. We need unity. We need to unite on a global effort, not just nationally. And so to me, that's the focus is like, how do we build a global anti-statist, like anti-authoritarian, horizontal movement? And let everyone else do that because they're already doing it, right? Like, it's going to be easy for liberals to mobilize, like leftists. It's going to be easy for you guys to, like, mobilize. But, like, when you're an autonomous individual, it's very hard to fight other autonomous people.
Yeah, and I think at least one thing that J20 shows is that, you know, I mean, obviously we've been doing this for a long time, but, you know, we can actually call big demonstrations and people will show up. You know, we don't have to basically play, you know, second fiddle or whatever, however you say it, to the left, basically.
Yeah.
Well, in your essay, The Anti-Blueprint, you write, "White, quote, whiteness is also an authority identity in the world, and even if we were to destroy all the borders and governmental bodies, the lineage of white supremacy will still linger on through their monopoly of violence and access to resources." Can you explain more of what you mean by this?
Okay, so to do that, I'm just going to have to briefly kind of talk about the anti-blueprint to give it context. So the anti-blueprint is sort of, for me, like a conversation starter of like, where do anti-statist, anti-authoritarian, horizontal, wanting people go from here? And so I try to break down what I mean by anti-state and anti-authoritarian. And I think that usually when people think of like authoritarian figures, they only think of, you know, presidents or leaders or, you know, some one person in a position of power. But I think that when you think of authority or authoritarianism, it's like it's in itself is an identity that can be in any of us at any moment, you know, and I think that it's important to recognize that so that we can be aware of it. And so for specifically like whiteness as an identity, it's like Andre 3000 had this shirt and it's like, you know, all over around the world, darker people like have it the worst, like why or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's like more like, you know, those of lighter skin all around the world are in the power position. And so we can't pretend that just because we get rid of nation states, that's going to go away. Mm-hmm. Or that because of white supremacy, that white people have been able to own, like, privatize land and have access to land and have access to weapons and have access to resources. And so, and also be able to defend themselves and attack with the protection of the state. So understanding all of that, then it's like, yeah, you know, we have to realize that like it's not equal. Like it's not, well, even for white anti-statists, like their access to things are still going to be more than me as a black anti-statist. And so, and there's nothing that you can't undo that. So it's kind of acknowledging like we have to acknowledge that. So we can't pretend like it's just going to be like, you know, this magical utopia once we get rid of these structures, because they're instilled in us.
Yeah, I agree. And that kind of ties into the next question. Another piece you have, quote, the myth of the white radical. You wrote that the elitist nature of white radicals can act as gatekeepers to radical action. Can you just explain that more? And is that part of, was that part of your own experience coming into activism or organizing or radical ideas?
Yeah, I wrote White Radical at a point where, you know, a lot of, I was just being confronted with the reality of anti-blackness in all my spaces. And really, like, the myth of White Radical could really kind of also be talked about just, like, all non-black people because, yeah, I just, sorry, something happened outside and distracted me. But yeah, it was kind of at this point where I was just experiencing a lot of anti-blackness and I'm realizing that I was hitting a wall with a lot of white radicals. And it was really sad. You know, I think a lot of times people think that when non-white people call out white people or like, you know, or try to like check their white friends that like, we love it. It's like this great thing. And no, it's like really sad. Because then you realize like, we're never like you're not going to get it. Like, you're not going to get like what your actions do that hurt me. Like, you're not going to understand like, you know, my life, my experience, my perspective, no matter how much I try to explain to you, you just aren't. So then it's kind of, you know, most of the radical spaces for a while were really dominated by whiteness and still is. Like, even a lot of media, you know, if you're a non-white person and you want to get something published or if you want to, like, get something shared, you have to usually go through a white rad. So it's sort of like in all of the places of, like, radicalness, there's, like, a white person that you have to go through and just kind of expressing that there's not a lot of specifically black, you know, radical spaces or black radical, you know, publishing. And so there's kind of just a dominance of whiteness in radical and radical ideas as well.
Yeah. I almost feel like it's, I mean, you know, this is my perception, but it seems like anarchism is getting less white, but still, like, you know, largely white. So it's like this weird, awkward thing where it's like, there's less white people and there seems to be more people of color, you know, articulating ideas, which is great. But at the same time, it's this weird thing where it's like, there's still a lot of white people. So it's kind of this weird thing where it's, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but like this, do you understand what I'm saying? Like we're not a white movement per se, but like there's a lot of white people and obviously we want it to be, you know, more representative of the people that we think that should be in a revolutionary movement. So it seems like this awkward thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of like people who are non-white who would, you know, who are kind of have like similar ideas to anarchism don't identify as anarchists. Like, I don't identify as anarchist. Sure. Because anarchism has been so much associated with whiteness, you know? And so I think in the sort of like the imagery of what we're seeing of anarchism or even anti-statist ideas or autonomy is still white, you know, like the Black Bloc at J20, like you still saw whiteness, you know, even though I'm sure there were many like non-white people, but like what you mostly saw in the footages or the pictures were like white people in Black Bloc, which is like the idea of Black Bloc, right? When you think Black Bloc, you think white people in Black Bloc, because in, you know, Ferguson and Baltimore, when people were like effing stuff up and doing property destruction, like they weren't in Bloc, you know, they were just like doing it. And so, and that's also kind of like, you know, it's, I don't know, it's like the separation of like class and identity, but like, you know, between like the Bloc and then just like when you have from like the Bloc you had at J20 from like, you know, the kids from the hood in Baltimore that were like burning stuff up. You know, I keep forgetting I can cuss because this is a radio. So
no liberal will hit you for saying that.
Yeah, but for burning shit up, you know, like They were out there without their mask because they didn't know any better. They were like young 16-year-old kids and, you know, burning cop cars and stuff. And they were just out there doing it. And like the sort of there is a difference, you know, from those two tactics, even though like they're similar. Like there's a difference from Black Bloc and from that.
Sure.
I feel like the way it's perceived, and I feel like, you know, Black Bloc is seen as like a political tactic, while like those kids rioting is seen as just like that. It's just like, I actually embrace the word riot, but other people use it as a shaming way. But they, but you know, as just people mindlessly looting or mindlessly being reckless and stuff, instead of like, no, that was a political strategic act by those youth, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's from my perspective, it's you know, obviously I think white people, you know, should be doing that anyway. Like, you know, even if it's just a bunch of white people, I would hope that they're like against whiteness and like against the state and taking those radical actions. But at the same time, like, obviously I think it's, I mean, what you bring up, like this kind of gatekeeper thing, you know, basically stopping people from, you know, coming into a movement, you know, just because they're dominating a space or just making it a certain way. I mean, what I saw like 10 years ago was that, you know, anti-authoritarians or, you know, however you describe them, it was more of a cultural thing. It was like, you know, you look like a choo-choo train conductor or a punk and had patches all over and, you know, you're like some like subcultural type, and like a lot of people didn't like want to associate with that. And now it seems to be less than that, but still, like, there's, like you said, there's a perception or like a connection to whiteness.
Yeah.
Well, you brought up a term that this leads into the next question, but you brought up a term, anti-blackness, and you talk about this in the essay that's on the top of your website. It's time for black liberation, not liberalism. And you use this term anti-blackness. I think some people may have heard of it if they're reading somebody like Frank Wilderson or other writers, but if people haven't heard it before, what do you actually mean by anti-blackness? Is it the same thing as white supremacy? Or how would you describe and define this term, and what do you mean in your writing?
For me, no, it's not the same thing as white supremacy. They go together. They support each other. You can't have anti-blackness without having white supremacy and vice versa. And so white supremacy is what allows whiteness to, you know, white supremacy is the result of anti-blackness. So, you know, the sort of attack and violence that black people face all around the world, is because, you know, black people, and then also on another layer of that, like darker people, are seen as less than. And so, so you can look at a place like a continent, like Africa, and so much of its like natural resources are controlled by outside sources. And like that's anti-blackness. And so in America, like everything from like slavery to, you know, not having, you know, sort of the ability to just like live and exist, like, is because we are black. Now, for black to be considered like the worst thing, right? Because that's how like white supremacy, anti-blackness works. Like black people are seen as like the bottom. Like you do not want to be black. And then whiteness is the best. So then that's why you have assimilation, where like, you know, people who are non-black POCs try to assimilate to whiteness because they're trying to get away from black. They're trying to get closer to white. So it's like almost like, you know, it's this field and blackness is on one side and white's on the other. And like black means, you know, you're going to be like, violence is going to happen to you. And, you know, you're going to constantly have to deal with attacks. And then whiteness means good, positive, like you have control and dominance and power. And so people try to stay away from the black because of what that means to be black. I don't know. It's a complicated answer, but yeah, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little more about that piece, Black Liberation, Not Liberalism, and just kind of get into some of those things that were into that, or that were in that essay?
So I originally wrote that 2 years ago, I think, and it was a subtweet to
You got some good tweets, by the way.
it was really just me, like, on the low talking about BLM, but not, like, directly doing it. And so, because it was still at that time where it was, like, I don't know. But, yeah, but in BLM, I mean the organization, not, like, the people who just go do stuff and not realize that, like, it's a nonprofit. but, so... It was kind of – so, yeah, it was after – I wrote that after the – what was the Ferguson uprising got co-opted by Black Lives Matter, and just being really frustrated with dealing with liberals and having to constantly, like, you know, be like, hey, like, why are we, like, being down with hierarchy when, like, hierarchy is, like, very anti-Black, you know? And so – and very against liberation and – and so it just basically tries to break down different aspects that Black people face and tries to challenge the idea that, like, liberal tactics work, because obviously they don't, right? Obviously reform doesn't work. Obviously, like, pleading to, like, hearts and minds of, like, non-Black people doesn't work, or else we wouldn't be in the situation we are right now. So if we want liberation, if we want autonomy, like, well, one, we have to understand, like, because I feel like liberation now is a word that's, like, being thrown around, and I'm like, well, do you really want liberation? Like, do you really want autonomy? Do you really want to be free? Because, like, how do you think you're going to do that and then give your power to a representative? Like, how are you going to have some ruler and then say you want to be a liberated person, you want to be free? Like, then why do you want to be liberated from, you know? Like, and so, yeah, so it's basically just, right, like, talking about why we shouldn't try reform, why it hasn't worked, why, and then it talks about, you know, a lot of internal problems that were going on in, like, Black Liberation Movement, or just, like, the anti-police brutality movement. Yeah. I'm bad at summarizing long pieces, I guess. A lot to try to summarize.
No, that was great. Have you gotten, like, pushback? I mean, because, I mean, obviously, like, I feel like what you're writing is totally right on, but, I mean, you're critiquing Black Lives Matter as an organization and basically saying, like, you know, this moment is really important, but, you know, are people, have they responded negatively to that? Because, like, for instance, one thing I hear a lot of, like, white liberals say is, like, we've got to listen to, like, leadership of color, whether that's, like, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe who's telling people to go home right now, or, like, the people in the movement for Black Lives, you know, like, that's the leadership. So when they hear someone like you say what you're saying, like, how do they react to that?
I don't know. They, you know, I haven't really gotten a lot of pushback from my more critical Black Lives Matter pieces directly. I mean, I'm sure indirectly people have told me they've heard things, but, like, directly I haven't gotten anything. Told me last December I'd cross the border this year more times than I can remember. Back and forth from Canada to the United States. Yeah, we hustle on the move, we do whatever it takes. And I never could have imagined I would travel so much. My brown undocumented people, y'all know that it's rough. Got gringos calling us illegals. We got indigenous blood, oh no, hold up. Must be playing, they the racist land invader, mass murder, earth betraying ones, Yo, much respect to all the natives who took time to share their stories. I can't put into words what y'all have really done for me. And Logan Savage fam been showing me the way, cultivating the race, motivating me to stay brave like a bimbo about to break. Please know we appreciate all our folks in the cut who steady bumping the music every show.
show was a blessing, blessing louder acoustic, taking notes from the youngsters who were holding it down in their ancestral homeland. They're gonna turn the shit around. To all the young sisters, always elevate your voice. You carry gifts within you, make some motherfucking noise. If some dude tries to shut you down or make you feel small, it's just cause they don't understand your power at all. Now we recognize the indigenous led land defense, worldwide native life demonstrating excellence. Born to ride, born to defy these crackers, colonial ignorance. These rhymes of resistance are what got me on the road. Believe I had to examine every word that I wrote, cause the youth were listening when I was standing to speak. Cause I'm coming from the struggle and they was feeling the beat, so I had to make sure that I was coming correct. Took time to sit back and really reflect. If you wanna build through the music, you must foresee its effect. But the learning curve's sharp, we don't got much time left. Don't got much time. Don't got much time left. No, no. Yo, rest in power to the students murdered in Ayotzinapa. Pinches puercos del gobierno se dieron cuenta lo que pasa. Intentaron enterrar semillas y país prendió fuego. Now waiting for anyone to free his homies in a lonely land, screaming fuck the police. We don't beg our oppressor, we hold court in the streets. Ferguson and coast to coast, it's open season on a pig. Fighting for our freedom is the only way we'll live. There's never been justice on stolen land. This needs to be the year the revolution began. There's never been justice on stolen land. This needs to be the year the revolution began. Was this the year the revolution began? Time will tell, time will tell. I ain't been sober like this since I was damn near 13. Ayo, I'm feeling so sharp, my mind's feeling so clean. See, I decided this year that I can't drink like I used to. But most of the homies always say, looking for an excuse to pour up a cup of that white man's piece. But when you good on that shit, you learn to tell them like this. The liquor makes you sick, them beers make you soft. The more that you drink, the more our people get lost. The liquor makes you sick, them beers make you soft. The more that you drink, the more our people get lost. But see, what really gets me heated is how proud you fucking sound, bragging about how many shots you about to show me you can pound. Me that's flashbacks in mis tios, borrachos growing up, who only showed their stolen faces when they needed a buck. They get into the cases and then my mind would be stuck cleaning up broken bottles and blood spilled from the fights, and that ain't even rock bottom.
Yeah, so I haven't gotten a lot of necessarily negative reaction from BLM or people who are supportive of BLM directly, maybe indirectly, but not directly. I've gotten more of a sort of, the most I've gotten sort of like a backlash for was for when I've critiqued white radicals. That was like the most where I had to deal with like being doxxed and stuff like that. But yeah, but I was saying on the, but on like the sort of tokenizing, like for white liberals to love to like kind of like tokenize and like kind of like point towards non-white said leadership, quote unquote. I talk about that in No Leaders, No Masters. And like, there's always this need and desire to have like a leadership of, for whatever, you know, community of color. Specifically in that piece, I'm talking about Black people. And, you know, that's a great thing to do because it's usually people who are going to be down with hierarchy and, you know, with even being calling themselves a leader, who are going to be able to be like bought out, which I also talk about in the Black Liberation piece. It's like why leadership doesn't work, because, you know, leaders can be compromised and leaders can be, you know, it's just not good strategically to have one person who's like in charge, who knows everything. Like, we've seen how that's worked out.
Right.
And so, so I think, yeah, white liberals love, like, people of color leaders, because then, you know, when they sell out, they can be like, well, look, this person said it, or they can get, like, their, you know, ally pen and say, well, I'm cool with this person, so I must be good. I'm not a racist, which I had someone do to me. I had this one white woman who's a liberal, and she was, like, really harassing me because, like, I was, like, openly calling her out for being racist on, like, one of these, like, BLM pages. Like, and this was in the beginning as the co-optation of BLM of Ferguson was happening. And, like, and she, like, private messaged me, and she was like, can you stop calling me out? And, like, if you don't call me out, anymore. I'll help get you published. And then, and I was just like, you know, like, wow, you're trying to buy me out, basically. And then on that thread was like, oh, I'm not racist, I'm cool. And then pointed, and then like mentioned this one black person as like why they're cool and like why they can't be a racist. And I was just like, all of that, like everything right there is why I can't like F with you, you know? But yeah.
Can you, just for people that are listening, I mean, like, I think for a lot of people, especially if they're not, like, in radical, political, whatever circles, like, most people think, like, basically the Ferguson insurrection and Black Lives Matter are the exact same thing. And, like, Black Lives Matter essentially is everything that encapsulates black revolt in the last, like, couple of years. Like, how would you define, like, Black Lives Matter, the nonprofit, the group, like, the moment, the movement, and, like, you know, also all these organic community uprisings that are happening. Like, how would you describe that to somebody?
So, I mean, for me, it began, like, before even Michael Brown, right? Like, so when Trayvon Martin, when the Zimmerman verdict came out about Trayvon Martin, everyone, like, went out and did stuff. Like, that was, like, kind of, like, the rebirth, right? Or, like, the beginning of, like, at least the most... JoJo. Hold up. No, Bubba. So, yeah. So, that was the beginning of, you know... This... Okay, he's gonna do this for... Let me see. Is the male person here? No. Baby, it's okay. Stop. Sorry. Okay. So... So when Zimmerman got off, that was basically, I feel like, the beginning of that wave. Mm-hmm. And then so the next year when Michael Brown was murdered by Darren Wilson, and then you had the Ferguson uprising, like, that was the Ferguson uprising. That's what everyone was referring it to. And so when Darren Wilson got off and there was all the solidarity uprisings, and it was, like, around November, like, people weren't calling it Black Lives Matter. They were calling it Ferguson Solidarity, like, solidarity with Ferguson. And so when the when there was, like, that caravan of people that, like, you know, went in there and basically, like, flooded Ferguson and co-opted it, right? And then all of a sudden, it became, like, Black Lives Matter. But, like, I remember using the Black Lives Matter hashtag and just thinking it was just a hashtag, and I didn't know it was associated with an org. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of people didn't know it was an org. And then all of a sudden it became like Black Lives Matter is the thing. And I remember there was like people were organizing a solidarity action with, people were organizing something. And it was some group that no one's ever heard of in LA. And so a lot of people were asking them on their event page, like, are you using a permit? Like, who is this? Like, you know. And it kind of got heated, and then so they had an open meeting. I went to the meeting, and I remember, you know, how when you do those, like, when you go to activist spaces or, like, intentional spaces, like, people do that thing where you go around and you say your name and what org you're with, which is, like, a whole thing. Right. When it came time for BLM to say that's who they were and that they were there, like, the way that the people hosting the meeting reacted to it was like, oh my God, we're so lucky to have you here. You know, like power. There was power. It was as if, like, you know, here are the leaders of the movement coming in and, like, whatever they say, go. And they were going on different event pages and telling people, oh, if you're using the BLM hashtag, like, you don't have the authority to use it. This isn't an authorized BLM event. Or why are you hosting an event the same day that BLM is having action? Like, they literally, like, took control, and the media allowed them to take control, right? Because it helps the media, plus it serves the state, for it to seem like it's, oh, BLM every time a black person does anything, because then it seems like it's controlled versus just, like, black people all around just, like, you know, spontaneously or just, like, autonomously doing their own stuff. And so... you know, now you have BLM, the org, now you have Movement for Black Lives, now you have all these spinoffs and, you know, D-Rays, Stay Woke, and he just came out with like a manual for resistance, you know. And like, you have these figureheads where you basically have the new leadership of like the generation for Black people. Like, they no longer is it Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, you know. Now it is like the founding three leaders of BLM, and it's D. Ray, and you know, yeah, and celebrities. And I think that like when you saw spontaneous uprisings happening in like New Orleans, or was it Baton Rouge, and Baltimore, and like various places, like that wasn't BLM initially. That was just Black people responding, and then that was BLM coming in and controlling. And so yeah, it's the same thing with all orgs, you know, like. They let the uprising happen, then they try to capitalize off it, and they brand it, and they take control of it, and then they, like, you know.
Yeah, we've had a couple people with the African People's Caucus, which is a caucus of Black anarchists and anti-authoritarians in the IWW, and the last time they were on the show, one of them was talking about, and I really like this part, but they were saying in their instance in Minneapolis, there's a real class dynamic. Like, the organizers of BLM are largely like grad students, and they'll come in from out of town and basically tell the people, you know, how to protest and stuff. And so they were describing that dynamic as well.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely an academic, you know, how are we gonna, you know, organize the hood kind of like mentality. And it's like very elitist to think that, like, you know, it's very elitist and very hierarchical and authoritarian to think that anyone needs to be organized. Like, that you need to go and tell people how they're going to resist, which is why, like, I have Can't Dictate Revolt as, like, the ending of It's Time for Black Liberation, Not Liberalism, because people try to dictate and control how people revolt and how people want to respond to, like, you know, being attacked, and you can't do that. And I think a lot of these organizations, that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to manage dissent for their own personal benefit. It's like in this era of Trump, you know, all these orgs, all these groups, you know, not just BLM, are going to get tons of money because, you know, people want to save, you know, people want ACLU to do stuff. And so they're going to donate, you know, all this money to ACLU. And then the nonprofit industrial complex is gonna do well. They always do well under a Republican president, like financially. And so, you know, while they get to take, you know, these like top positions of, you know, discussing how we're going to resist, you know, against Trump and against like all the waves of violence are about to approach us, they also still are comfortable in like their middle class or middle upper class, you know, privilege. And so they get both benefits. You know, they get to be like a stronger, louder voice when you have like a Republican president, and they get funding, but they also don't have to really worry about like the harm that's going to happen, you know? And so, it's really unfair to people who are really trying to like fight for their life.
Well, that kind of leads us, I mean, you kind of answered a little bit, but how do you see the various BLM like official formations? What do you see them doing, you know, under Trump in the next couple of years? And also, what do you think the future holds for organic grassroots Black insurgency as well?
It's hard to say because, like, you know, they did the shutdown, right? And like, that's, I kind of just see BLM doing more than that. Like, it's kind of like what they're cool with. And I think they'll shut down more freeways. I think they'll do more like, you know, sort of civil disobedient like tactics. And I think as a org, they'll just become, you know, they have replaced the NAACP. So I think that will be the future of BLM. And I think they'll find ways to be able to go into politics locally while still being able to keep their radical element by doing these, like, you know, big spectacle CD actions. And that's why, like, BLM is, they have this awesome benefit as organization where, like, there's BLM the org, but then there's also BLM the movement. So if some young, you know, black kids decide they want to do something and it's like dope as fuck and they have like a BLM poster, then cool. Guess what? BLM gets credit for that. But if BLM, the org, wants to distance themselves from it, they always can because, well, that's not actually the organization. That's just like, you know, someone using, that's just the movement. That's the larger movement.
Some poor person that's really angry.
Huh?
Some poor person that's angry and trying to do something.
Yeah. They, you know, they get to benefit. Whereas, like, you know, all those kids in Baltimore who, you know, are getting real, you know, scary time and stuff like that. Like, they're not getting the support of, like, BLM, the institution. The Ferguson people, like, who, you know, there's people in Ferguson who are still, like, where'd the money go? So, so there's, like, there's definitely going to continue to be a disconnect. And also, this thing about, like, Trump as a president, it kind of has made it so that, like, I think liberals and, like, a lot of, especially, like, white liberals love having a Republican president and kind of secretly love Trump because then it takes away the attention from, like, you know, them having to look in the mirror into their being, like, a bad white person that now they can, like, focus attention on. And so I think that, like, you're going to see people, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm hopeful. Like, yeah, I think you'll still see, you know, autonomous action happening against police brutality, since that seems to be like the direct focus of sort of black resistance right now. But I'm hoping that it goes more towards like an autonomous anti-statist direction. I think it naturally already is, but I just feel like for some reason. But because of, like, so much of, like, so, like, black leadership being so strong in, like, the community that, like, that gets suppressed. But maybe now that President Obama's gone, that it'll be easier for people to be open to other type of politics.
Do you think coming out of, you know, 8 years of Obama, like, that makes it easier also to critique electoral politics and say, like, you know, look at everything that's happened, like more black wealth have disappeared since any time since the Great Depression, you know, 3 people a day on average are being killed by police in the United States. Like, what actually has changed?
I mean, yeah, right? Like, you can do, like, I feel you can look at and argue, like, if reform was a hypothesis and we were going to, like, attempt to look at it as, like, you know, applying scientific theory, it's failed. And it hasn't worked. And, like, you know, how many times do we have to try to elect someone and hope that, like, they're going to be able to answer, like, and fix all the problems? Like, it's just not possible. It just doesn't work. And so it's like, yeah, we had a black president and, like, you know, he said he was going to do this and this and this and didn't. And so it's like, now, you know, you need to do something else. It's not going to work. And I think that did happen. I think, honestly, like, I think that was, like, the one of the best things that came out of his presidency is, like, a lot of young people who, you know, that was the first time they voted and they saw what happened. They're like, nope. But, you know, and they didn't vote. They didn't come out and vote. And, you know, in 2012, they didn't come out and vote in 2016. So I think it already did that.
Yeah, and I think, like, that's one of the big key you know, task in the next couple of years is like basically making sure that, you know, our side, autonomous, horizontally organized, like make sure that becomes the thing that people are mobilizing around, not, you know, waiting 4 more years for a Democrat to take office. Because I don't know, I find it hard to believe that Trump will get reelected. Or I don't know, him step down and Pence, you know, take over or something like that. I don't know. So my question was, for revolutionaries that are interested in anti-authoritarian horizontal organizing, what do you think that they should be asking themselves and thinking about, you know, in this period with Trump now in office?
I think there is sort of, I think we're in this new place where, and I use new knowing that, like, obviously there has been elements of repression that people have been dealing with in their day-to-day, like, before Trump took office. But I mean, as, like, a larger movement, I think what we saw with J20 and with how hard they went at the Black Bloc and, you know, the fact that all their phones and stuff got taken and held on to, which, like, you can only imagine all the things they're going to be doing with that, that we are in this stage of, like, we need to get really serious about our security culture and take it a lot more seriously. There's some of us who are already burned, I think that we need to figure out how to support each other and ourselves. And, you know, a lot of the tactics that, you know, would have been okay to do in a slower pace of, like, being attacked, might have worked, like marching and just like demos and that kind of stuff. You know, we can't do that. We can't pretend like those work anymore. Like, we can't keep doing that. Like, we have to escalate our tactics and we have to, you know, be prepared to be those people that do that. You know, no longer can we just watch, like, you know, riot porn from Europe and be like, well, that's dope, they do that. And not apply those same things here. So I think a lot of it's going to have to be, like, just, yeah, like, preparing for, like, what is about to come. Like, if Trump goes and says, okay, everyone, you know, we're deporting everyone on DACA and we have all their info and we're going to start going into their houses, like, what does that mean? You know, does that mean we're going to go marching to City Hall against that? Or does that mean we're going to be standing in front of these people's houses, you know, creating, like, barricades saying, no, you're not? And, like, does that mean that, like, if they have buses of, like, people they're going to put into ICE centers, we're going to be going into those buses and disrupt, like, intervening? And, like, you know, like, I think our tactics have to be really more, you know, intervention instead of just, like, responding in the kind of, like, symbolic gestures. Like, we really do have to start doing what other people around the world have already been doing.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing, too, is just, like, punching through that kind of bullshit liberal, you know, someone will listen if we make a good statement, you know, make a good spectacle, like, getting to that point of, like, physically doing something that I think most everyday, normal, poor, working class people can see, like, you know, hey, there's a benefit in doing this, and that's why we do X, Y, Z.
Yeah, I mean, it's gonna be really, like, it's gonna get way more real, you know. I've already can tell with my friends who usually aren't really political, but, like, now they're, like, you know, they're scared. And I think a lot of people who were, you know, like, with Hillary, I think people are really mad that Hillary didn't win, because with Hillary as president, you can kind of, like, ignore all the other things. Like, yes, we were droning people, okay, yeah, we were bombing people, okay, yeah, sure, people were still getting deported, but, like, eh, I still could, like, you know, go on and live my life, and I can just ignore that. I don't pay attention to politics, you know. You could still do that kind of thing. But it's, like, now with Trump, like, he's affecting other elements of people's lives that, like, you can't ignore. You can't ignore that you're not gonna have health insurance, you know, like, right. You can't ignore that, like, he's, yeah, just, like, the different things that's happening. And so, yeah.
I just found this thing on Twitter the other day. It's called, like, @Trump_regrets, and it's, like, all basically, mostly white people, like, basically saying, like, why the fuck did I vote for Trump? Because,
yeah,
something, have you seen this?
I've heard about it. I've seen people post a bunch of it, and, like,
yeah.
And it's just, yeah. Like, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he just, like, slashed FHA premiums, like, basically making it harder for first-time homebuyers to buy a house. It'd be more expensive. So a lot of people were pissed about that. Obviously, healthcare is a big thing. But, I mean, you know, Paul Ryan, like, all those people, like, they want everything. Like, ideologically, mm-hmm. they want a pure free market, no entitlement benefit programs whatsoever. And I don't know. I just think a lot of people there – a lot of people. I think there's a possibility that some white people are, you know, they bought, you know, a pie of racism, and now they're getting class war, and they're going to see, like, how fucked they're about to get in some ways. And I think that there is a possibility to reach some people at that point to just be like, look, like, you know, they want all this shit, and you're going to get fucked.
Yeah, earlier you were saying you don't think he's going to get elected and he's going to get reelected in 2020, where I still feel like he could, you know, like, I really do. And I think, like, and I think I'm not seeing any sign from, like, the Democratic Party that they're going to acknowledge, like, why they lost, right? I'm still hearing a lot of shit being blamed on people for not voting. And just kind of like deflecting on that. And so I think that Trump is he did reality TV. He did reality TV well, and he knows how to do it. You know, he knows how to market and like how to do the slogan. And I think Democrats are still going to continue to like be Democrats and not know like, you know, how to campaign against like someone who's a celebrity like that, you know, just like they didn't know how to run against Arnold Schwarzenegger for the recall in governor for California. And as long as we still have like people wanting to only believe in the two-party system and focus all their time on, you know, electoral politics, which is like consistently happening, like I think the white working class is still going to side with Republicans unless like the Democrats, you know, have someone like a Bernie, you know, like who seems like they're against the establishment. But I don't know.
Yeah. Well, just the other day, I think Bernie came out saying he was excited by Trump's talk about at some time, you know, renegotiating NAFTA with Canada and pulling out of the TPP, which was already, you know, a done deal. It was already over. But he's basically signaling, like, not only is he down to work with the regime, but now he's starting to get excited because some of his policies are lining up with Trump's American nationalist populist thing.
Yeah, that's why you can't really trust, you know, like, that, you know, and that's why, and that's also why I feel about, like, this whole thing on, like, trying to fight to get the white working class on, like, you know, to be favorable to my cause, because it's like, well, yeah, but like as soon as something economically changes for you, like then I'm still back at square one. So it's like this idea that we could just have focus on class, like it doesn't work because when it comes down to it, people are still going to be anti-black, still going to want to have like white dominance.
Yeah, and I think that's what's like, I think, not only people that are, like, stuck that I see, like, in a really, like, classical Marxist, like, everything comes from Europe and Marx and Lenin and everything, but, you know, also there's, like, a lot of anarchists like that, too. But, you know, just, like, we've got to understand, like, we're in America, and this is, like, you know, what we're up against, like, this, you know, configuration of white supremacy, anti-blackness, class society, patriarchy, all these things. It's, like, you know, unique to our context.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, like a lot of what other people's revolutions are looking like and resistance is going to look like isn't going to look like ours, you know, because we are such a melting pot and because like there's so much happening here and because we're in the belly of the beast, like there, it's going to be, and that's why I liked it, the anti-blueprint, why I wanted to focus on Syria. Because, you know, you have the revolution and then you have civil war and then you have like autonomous, you know, zones being created. But even amongst those autonomous zones, you have like still authoritarianism still like taking place, you know. And I think we can look at a lot of places and see what's going on and what happened and like understand that's going to be us. And, you know, except like the alt-right, you know, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, fascists, like, have tons of ammo and guns that they've been like storing for 8 years, you know, and like using like their coupon clippings to get like full like garage full of food. Like they are prepared for war and we are not. And that is something that is scary and important, but also like, you know, just because it's overwhelming doesn't mean it's impossible. But I think we should know our enemy and know like they have been preparing for it. So while we're debating tactics, like they already have the guns and they already are shooting people, right? Antifa just got shot. So I want to, I'm tired of playing catch up. Like,
right.
I hope that, and I think that's again why we can't have unity with liberals, because like they hold us back and we're spending so much energy trying to like explain to them why like certain tactics don't work and why we need to do something else. And it consistently keeps us from moving forward. Like, you know, I say in, the Fuck You, Funk Trump article, or Fuck Trump and Fuck You article, like, you know, what's the point of pushing the line, the riot line, if we're constantly going to be pushed back by liberalism? And it's like, it feels like that. It feels like which each way we go back to start, instead of it being like, well, no, we're just continuously pushing and getting like, you know, more refined in our tactics and approach.
Well, on that note, that was a great ender. To ask a funny question, what's your favorite Richard Spencer getting punched video?
Okay, so I have a couple. I really like the Biggie Smalls one.
Oh yeah, yeah, the Hypnotize.
Yes.
Yes.
And I love the Sonic the Hedgehog where like he punches and all like the coins go off.
I don't want to take credit for that as IGD, but IGD did write that, you know, because Richard Spencer comes from this like really wealthy family and like he has this giant trust fund. We said we half expected coins to fly out of his ass, like. Somebody got punched, and then magically, right after we wrote that in that article,
yeah.
Somebody made that. So maybe it was awesome. Us, maybe it wasn't, but it was great.
Yeah, that one, and then there's the Blue Monday one is really good. I love it. I hope that like it's a spinoff and more people do it. Like, you know, I think we can make it into like a whole thing, like punch a Nazi, and then like people just like send their videos of them punching Nazis and like remixing it to different songs and like. Yeah. I love it. I want more.
He said he's worried that this will be the meme to end all memes, which is just hilarious because he was literally talking about the Pepe the Frog meme when he got punched.
Yeah, it was like the timing was so perfect. It was so perfect. Oh my gosh. And then, yeah, it was great. Because, like, he's sitting there, and the question I love, I can't really hear it, but, like, someone before is like, so are you, like, a hipster? And then, like, I don't know if he's saying like hipster Nazi or something, and like it's perfect because he's like, well, the Pepe, and then he's like, boom, he gets like punched, and you're just like, yeah,
it's amazing. It's great. Well, just in closing, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been a great conversation. Thanks so much for sharing. It's great to talk and just, you know, laugh, but also think critically, and all the stuff you brought up was really great. Anything else you want to add? And more importantly, where can people find more of your work? And you have a Patreon account. How can people support you so you can continue to do this? And anything else you want to add?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun talking. And if you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter at @I_can_love. And you can find all my past writing on thisisbobbylondon.com, and there's a link to my Patreon and basically everything there. So if you want to keep in touch or anything, then that'd be a good place.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll have to have you on again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Love talking to you.